Hello, and welcome to Future of London's City Bites podcast. I'm Lisa Taylor, Executive Director of Future of London and Director of Coherent Cities. This episode is the second in our Learning from Crisis Connections series, where we explore how the pandemic is changing our relationship to shared space, community engagement, culture, connectivity, and more. This episode is on how community engagement has changed, on what's working and what isn't, and on what aspects of this new world of communication might be with us for the long haul. In some cases, online engagement has meant more people are taking part. Maybe they don't have to travel, they have more time to get involved, or their neighborhoods feel more important than ever. On the other hand, there are real concerns about equality around broadband access, home setup, privacy, and more. The risk of leaving out whole swathes of people was there before COVID, but it's now more glaring, and it might be more likely to be addressed. Today, we'll hear from three people who are directly involved in these changes. Jenna Goldberg is a director at London Communications Agency. Her company is either researching or directly involved in planning activity across London. She's going to talk about what they're seeing different councils do and how various tools are working. Jamal Mia will talk about what we're doing. Jamal is a community liaison officer with Camden Council, working with the West Kentish Town Estate. They're still having to work very hard to reach people, and they're trying to find new ways to include them. Last but definitely not least, Sib Trigg will share what we're experiencing. Sib is an architect and an organizer with PEACH, the People's Empowerment Alliance for Custom House. With priorities that include jobs, health, safety, and housing, PEACH members must work to communicate with each other, as well as with Newham Council and potential development partners. Jenna, I mean, we're all obviously moved online at this point, at least for 90% of the work that's being done. What are you seeing at London Communications Agency across London? Who's doing what?
I think what we're seeing is just a hugely positive picture of what London's local authorities have managed to achieve over the last 3 or 4 months. You know, since March, if you had said that we were going to plan for a mass digitalisation of consultation and that London's kind of public sector was going to lead that charge, you would have been thinking, oh, that's a 2 to 3 year programme, that's unlimited public funds, there'll be a couple of catastrophes along the way. But no, it took everyone maybe 6 weeks to adapt. We're very much now, I think, fully adapted to the situation. Having said that, it's a fluid situation still, and things are still changing. I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later. I have been hugely impressed with how much everyone has been able to achieve, and actually barely missing a beat across all the boroughs that I'm working in, you know, getting schemes consulted on, getting people engaged, getting things through the planning system, getting decisions and determinations made. There's been fairly little delay, I would say, and it would be interesting to kind of discuss and debate that with you all today. I feel really positive about everything, and I've just been impressed.
Well, great. I'm glad to hear that, actually. It's a good way to start. I'm actually going to go straight to the source, as it were, with Jamal, who works with Camden Council. He's been working on the West Kentish Town Estate, doing community liaison work. How is the transition for you at Camden? You were well underway with the regen scheme that you were working on. How did you guys manage to adapt?
Lockdown happened so quick, we didn't even prepare for it. We didn't have no time, so we just went into lockdown. And because I'm more on the ground, where residents wants to come and drop in our offices and ask about what's happening, the next steps of the regen. When we went down, we obviously had meetings with our senior development managers, our land managers, and we wanted to find ways of interacting or having online sessions. How would that work? Through our West Kentish Town team, we did find ways of interacting, and one way was, because 18 months ago, we did a housing needs survey where we got residents' details. And the only way we called every resident on their estate to find out what their weaknesses or they're struggling on. Like, for example, someone that might be illiterate who might not can't read or write, how can we engage with them, keep them engaged? There's some people who don't even like technology at all or who don't want to interact at all. How do we convince them? How do we build that rapport with them to say, you know what, trust us and what we're doing is beneficial for you?
So I'm actually going to ask this question to Sib next, but how are you building that rapport if it's just a voice on the end of the line?
Well, it was really hard at the beginning because they have that oh, we don't trust the council. And everyone has that because everyone has had a run-in with the council. So when we knocked on the doors, we introduced ourselves. We had a lot of residents slam the door. And I think the only way to build that rapport is to show them that they can trust you. So in a way, I've listened to the problem. So it's just like, for example, I knocked on the door. They will complain about Camden Council. It's got nothing to do with me, but I've listened. So they built that little thing with him. Oh, he actually listens. Then I've gone and said to them, I don't know what I can do, but I'll try my best to sort something out for you. For example, I'll knock to one resident's door and they'll complain about the repairs. I've listened to them and I've said to them, okay, it's not my field. I can't do nothing about it, but I'll see, I'll contact, I'll email, and I'll build the trust from there. So now I do send text messages, just a drop-in call, just to ask how they are. You know, even COVID, everyone's going through a tough time. You know, I've gone through a tough time. To build that rapport, I've become friends with them now, with the residents. I drop in a call, random phone call, just to ask them how they are. Not even got to do with anything with Regen. Oh, how are you? How's everything? What can I do to help you? And now, even if I said anything about Regen, if I said to them, well, we've got online session, they're like, what time? I'll be there, Jamal.
That's huge. That's such a big difference, what you've done. As I say, I'm going to ask Sib about this as well, in terms of what she's doing at Custom House. Sib, so in the same vein, what are you guys experiencing as Peach in terms of being on the receiving end of communication, either from council or potential developer or agency partners?
So there's been a few different things going on in Custom House. So when lockdown started, our main concern at Peach was to support the community. We did quite a large phone-in listening campaign to find out what people were struggling with. And we ended up setting up a community kitchen, delivering hot meals for residents on a sort of pay what you feel basis, and also ended up putting together activity packs for children and adults, which were delivered once a week, so on alternating weeks. So the children's packs would go out one Monday, adults packs would go out the next Monday, and they had lots of things in them, like books and colouring and seeds for people to plant so they can grow sunflowers and stuff to just kind of make people's lives easier. From residents' perspective, it felt like the council was going to push ahead with kind of engagement plans on the regeneration when the whole of the rest of the world had been turned upside down, and you know, people couldn't go to work, they couldn't necessarily support their families, they were doing childcare or like had other caring responsibilities, and there hadn't been that much consideration then of like just how much the lockdown and the COVID situation had affected people's lives who don't necessarily have the space in their homes or access to technology to do their work in different ways or be able to find some ways of looking after their kids when they also have to work, and you know, all the things that lots of people have experienced now sort of 4 months later. Saying that, we also did a lot of work with residents, getting people on Zoom, getting people comfortable with sort of online platforms. On the 11th of July, we held a People's Guarantees meeting. So there's going to be a ballot in Custom House on the regeneration in October, potentially. And so we've been doing a lot of work around the landlord offer alongside Newham. And we put together the People's Guarantees, which is a document that contains all of the things that residents need to see in the landlord offer to make the regeneration work for them. And so we held an online meeting to launch that on the 11th of July, and we actually had 70 residents turn up to the Zoom call, and the Mayor of Newham and some of the regeneration officers. So that was a massive success, and felt like all of the work that had been done by the community organisers in Custom House, going around, knocking on people's doors, delivering leaflets, delivering food, delivering activity packs, chatting to people, really did build the community stronger in a way that it hadn't necessarily made obvious before lockdown.
Can I check? I mean, you and Jamal are both talking about the human aspect, helping, checking in, being there on the personal side as well as in terms of schemes. Did, when you talked about that feeling that it was sort of rushing ahead too much and not considering what was happening to people's lives, has that improved at all, or you still feel like you're fighting against that?
I think it has improved somewhat. But I think there is a little bit of a disconnect between just in terms of the amount of information that gets out there in this kind of context compared to when there can be face-to-face meetings and there can be drop-in sessions and there can be things like a physical space and drawings and models and conversations with people that residents can engage with in terms of the regeneration, that these kinds of online substitute for community engagement is a substitute. It's not doing the same thing. And so I think there is a feeling that it's trying to stick to the same timescales as pre-lockdown when the method of engagement is inferior just because people aren't used to it, definitely has a detrimental effect on how much people are able to engage with it.
Thanks. I'm going to go to Jenna with that, with a sort of London-wide view. I'm seeing the same thing in terms of just the quantity of information people get thrown when they're asked to come into an online session. And it's tempting, as you say, to try and give everyone what they can. Jenna, are you seeing any of this? Because obviously when your people are involved in helping with engagement or being involved in that, what are you seeing in terms of this volume of information? And is anybody figuring that out?
I mean, just to say, I totally agree with what Siv has just said, and we talked about it a bit in the last webinar, I think, which is that, you know, especially when we were kind of deep into crisis mode, and it's easy to forget how I think we all felt in, say, April versus now. I think we feel quite differently. But when we were sort of deep into that crisis mode, we talked about how people need time and people need humanity. And you know, I was consulting on a scheme back in April, rightly or wrongly, the government guidance was that we should be consulting and we should be, you know, trying to get things through planning. And people were saying to us, you know, I don't know how you think I've got the headspace for this right now. We're in a crisis and I can't think about a tower going up next door. And, you know, our response was obviously one of compassion and to say, well, we're going to give you time. We're going to take more time over this than we would have done normally. And that's certainly in my experience been true across the board. You know, 6-week consultation periods became 8, 10, 12-week consultation periods. And we're going to try and just listen and be as compassionate as we can through this whole process. I mean, I think in terms of the question you've asked about information, that's really interesting because I think there are major benefits to consulting in this more sort of, if you like, multimedia way. But I agree again, so I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's inferior only because people aren't used to it. As people get used to it, I think we'll realise the benefits of it more. And I think we'll certainly get to a point, I hope, once the sort of pandemic crisis eases, that we'll knot all of this together. So you'll have consultations and engagement processes that are both online and in person, and you'll use all these new tools that we've learned to use so well alongside that really important physical engagement. But I think in terms of managing information and putting together a really compelling and coherent way of explaining change to people, and after all, that's usually what we're talking about. We're usually talking about explaining change in a coherent and as simple as way as possible. Actually, kind of online has huge benefits. So I know, you know, for an NHS consultation that we've just finished in South London, we produced some incredible videos. We've just done for a consultation in the city, master plan exploration tool that people can use online. So just thinking really creatively about how you can explain how things are going to look and feel without actually being physically present there to explain it to them. Now, I'm not saying any of that is the ideal situation, and there's nothing like being in a room with an architect, you know, taking you through a model and being able to ask every question live. But there are some really great ways that you can boil this information down, and it's been a good challenge, I think, to everyone in the built environment sector to meet certain factions within the sector that have generally not been good at that, and are now being put to the test. And I'd probably put, I'm sorry to my architect colleagues, and that's why I have a job, is that they generally are not the best at sort of taking their work, their wonderful, amazing work that I could never do, and explaining it in plainest of English to somebody who, you know, has never worked in the built environment and doesn't understand it at all. So that's been a really positive thing that's come from this.
Sib, I'm going to ask you next about this question of how do you communicate something visually? And then I'm going to go to Jamal after that to ask about this. What about people who aren't online? But I'll ask you that too. So Sib, how do you get across something that's visual when you've got a little tiny box?
I mean, I don't know if anyone's going to like this answer, but I just don't think you can.
I'm with you.
I think you can go, you can go a certain way towards it. Like the way that people process the kind of information of you know, urban design drawings or models or images, it isn't necessarily a linear process. And so if you're talking about if you're trying to talk people through something that they're unfamiliar with, the way that people are used to receiving those kinds of presentations is in a kind of linear format, like almost like a PowerPoint. People will say, oh, we'll put a presentation together and we'll do it online instead of in real life. But that assumes that the people are going to ingest that kind of information in the order that you're presenting it. Whereas when you have a sort of display wall, you can kind of take in bits of the display that people aren't necessarily talking about at the time that, you know, if you're having it explained to you, and there's a much wider sense of what is going on. So and then on top of that, you have to take into account that everyone has different screen sizes, different finger sizes, you know, in terms of like being able to scroll around things and zoom in and out. And I think even though it has an important role, like there isn't really a way that you can substitute it for real life.
I'm with you. I think there is something too about being able to look around in an exhibition. You also have different staff people who can deal with you instead of being in one sort of one direction thing.
Being able to walk away for a minute and then come back to it and have that sort of processing time in between, you know, not just having this sort of, now I'm concentrating on this and now it's over, right? The people don't necessarily think like that.
No, and there will be someone looking at roof heights and someone else asking about procurement and all this, and you can do that when you're live. Yeah. Good points, thank you. Jamal, I'm going to come to you on that question about your exhibition this afternoon. I'm assuming, is that a live in-person exhibition today?
Yes, we have an online session, which is, so we did an online session last month. It was based on COVID-19 and our findings. And this exhibition today at 3 o'clock is about the next steps and master planning, hiring a design team and a master planning team.
So is that, are you going to be in person somewhere or is that online also?
It's going to be online. Everything's going to be online.
Well, I'm wondering about this question. Are you missing this idea of actually being in a room with a few staff and people, or do you think you're able to get some of this stuff across to residents well enough using the internet?
Online is very difficult because we get around 20 to 25 people come on. Having a drop-in session where anyone could just drop in and it's face-to-face, we find it that a lot more majority of people come to that. They find it more easier to interact with us. Say, for example, if I was doing a presentation, technology is not the strongest point, so they just dial in and they can't see the presentation. So I could be reading off something and they're just thinking, oh, why is he reading off? You know, because they might not have that. But if it was a drop-in session and it's face-to-face, we have the boards up so they could physically see it as well.
Okay, I get that. And I agree with you. I'm wondering too, what do you do in cases where people don't have internet access?
So if people don't have internet access, I do send them reminders to say, oh, we have an online session, you could dial in. What I can do for you, if they don't understand anything or if they're shy to ask questions, I do give them I could give them to them on a one-to-one basis so they could call me after and I could go in depth. Because, you know, sometimes 1 hour slot, because, you know, a lot of people have kids to feed. They've got other things, you know, small children. Some people have work. So what I'll do is if they can't, we're trying to cram everything in 1 hour and it's just, start in and then questions and then finish, where if they called me private, for example, on a one-to-one, I can go through them in depth and explain to them. And because I've built that rapport with them, they're not shy to ask a question or they're not shy to say, oh, I don't understand this. Can you elaborate on this? Or what do you mean by this? I didn't understand that, but can you explain this further, please?
I wanted to check with you. I've just got really two more questions for all of you. And one, and I'll start with you, Jamal, is you guys, you knew some of these residents, you knew the issues, you'd met people in some way or other before we went into lockdown. So you had a chance to build live rapport. So I would ask you, what do you think people can do if they're starting on a scheme that's just begun, they've never met, or they're in a relationship where they've never met their stakeholders? From your own experience, what do you think they might try to build some of that communication and rapport?
We started 18 months ago and we started off as a need survey. So we knocked on everyone's door. This is me going 18 months back. Me and my colleague, we knocked on doors, West Kensington, every door to do a housing need survey. And that included how many people live in that house, what do you like about the area, what you don't like about the area, what you like about your household, what you don't like about your household, what would you change, what would you like? Just like a wish list, for example, as well. And then from there, benefit of that is because I live around the area. I do my shopping in the area. Even if it's my day off on a Tuesday or a Thursday or a Saturday or a Sunday, residents will stop me and they'll ask me questions and I'm there. So even though I work 3 days, I work 7 days. I understand what they're going through. I myself live in a council house as well. I have my, you know, issues in my block and things like that. So I understand. I don't live in a mansion where, you know, I don't know where they're coming from. I understand where they're coming from. So, but it's just giving your time to them.
So do you think that also works online? So you've had the opportunity to go door knocking and meet people and see people on the street. I mean, yeah. Now things are relaxing a bit. You might do door knocking, but they might not want to talk to you or feel safe. So if you had to be just online, how could you do that?
Yeah, so we did an exercise a couple of weeks ago. Called around 276 residents. We called everyone. And because they know us, we introduced them. Hi, my name is Jamal from the WKT Regeneration Team. They're quick to say, you don't need to tell me this, Jamal. I already know you. Because I built that rapport, I could just go straight to it. And I'll be like, I won't take enough of that much of your time. It's got a few questions. What are you struggling on? Do you have a laptop? Do you have a mobile? From there, we took that information. So we had 132 people answer from 276. From there, we had 60 people said they'll come on do online, depending on time, because of children, work. So what I do is I ring them. A day before, I'll send them a text message just to say, oh, gentle reminder, you've got an exhibition at this time, at this day. Give me a call if you're struggling. A amount of people call me straight away, say, oh, how do I download this? How do I download this? So it's got that personal trust that I'm there for them and I'm helping them. Sorry, another thing we found that is really important is that if you have a large team and they're all doing door knocking as well and they're speaking to residents as well, because I might be on holiday and then they might call one of my colleagues, is giving the same message, being consistent with the message.
Thanks, Jamal. So actually, I'm going to ask that same question in terms of, you know, how do you build rapport? I'm actually going to ask Jenna this in terms of if you've never met and you're just starting something, I imagine that probably happens with you on even a partner basis, a client basis. How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot harder, that's for sure. And I'm thinking about clients that I haven't met yet and just trying to build up that relationship, or associates or even new colleagues who have joined since lockdown and who I've never met. I think we all know that that's much harder. I wanted to just respond to a couple of things that Jamal has said, because I think he raised some really good points. Thinking about this whole picture, and I think there's some important nuances to pick up. So one is that I think there are limitations to physical engagement as well. So it's not, you know, we talk about it as this sort of, that's the ideal that we perhaps want to get back to, and it is really important, but it does also have limitations. And I think we can all see that, you know, pre-COVID, before we even knew that word, we would have said that actually the planning system, you know, favours those with time, the time to come to an exhibition, the time to respond to a consultation. That demographic, in my experience, skewed slightly older, skewed whiter, and probably skewed sort of more towards suburban, outer London fringes as well, where the communities are less transient. I mean, that's, you know, that's my instinctive take. I could be wrong, but I would have thought that's broadly correct. So a lot of what we're talking about here has advantages in that it helps us to reach people who previously would not have been minded to have been involved in planning or regeneration in any way. And I think that's really important to remember. The other thing is about this cycle of development and the timeline. And in my experience of things that I've been working on over the last few months, actually there's only a tiny percentage of schemes or projects that started in lockdown and finished in lockdown, you know, or finished sort of, you know, before the kind of restrictions were eased to the point that they are now, for example. Those would be quite small schemes that, you know, only had a kind of six week consultation period. So actually that's only a very small percentage where you would have had no chance of meeting anybody or knocking on a door. You know, one of the things that I'm thinking about now, especially for my kind of bigger, more complicated town centre regeneration I'm working on, is, okay, well, we're starting this under COVID restrictions. So we're starting with, we probably can't meet people right now, but we really hope that we will be able to meet them at some point in the process. So how can we use this time now to really build a great foundation for what we're doing? And I think, you know, we haven't really talked about online tools and the platforms that exist. And there are, you know, there are kind of off the shelf ones you can use, but you can equally build your own. You know, I know Camden likes Commonplace a lot. There's Built ID, there's Bang the Table. There's a whole range in the market. And to a certain extent, all we're really talking about here is kind of fancy-ish websites, but you can use those tools, and in combination, I agree, with other more traditional methods of engagement, like the good old-fashioned phone call, letters through doors, brochures through doors, etc., to start to figure out who your community is, who wants to talk to you, who maybe has never been involved in a planning application before but actually would quite like to be. And so we kind of, you know, we're talking to clients now about using this time to do that mapping work, a kind of audit of their community, and particularly those that they didn't know were there before. And then hopefully as we move into, you know, next year, we really hope that we'll be able to do some physical engagement and to get people really interacting with the spaces that we're talking about. Because, yeah, I agree, nothing can really beat walking around a space and thinking about what could be different and what could work better. But you can certainly plant those seeds and build that foundation now. Finally, I just wanted to just pick up on one other distinction. There's a difference between, say, an estate regeneration, where you have a very natural and interested and invested constituent community who will turn up to a meeting, you know, with all the great work that, you know, people like Jamal do, will turn up because, you know, it affects literally their own homes, to say a town centre regeneration or, you know, something a little bit more disparate, where you do have to do the real legwork to even explain to people what, you know, how this is going to affect them and why it's going to affect them and why they should be interested, and to lay the foundations for that, to create that constituent community. And I think COVID, again, could be a real boon there. You know, we've seen, I don't know, I assume you're all part of some sort of local WhatsApp or mutual aid group. Many people are. I certainly am. It's been brilliant. But actually, as we see neighbours who have never spoken to each other, never taken any interest in each other before, suddenly have a means of connecting. I mean, I'm on a WhatsApp group now with my ward councillors. I'm a fairly politically engaged person. I've never really taken any notice of them before because I'm in the privileged position of not really needing to. But now I have a direct line into them and my neighbours. So I think that will be a great benefit to the sort of planning and engagement process from now on, especially when we can once again engage sort of in person with each other, complemented by all these other methods as well.
Thanks, Jenna. Sib, I'm going to come to you, Sib, on this question of, you know, well, what's worth keeping? Councils and organizations are going to want to keep some of this stuff for the benefits that Jenna's described about reaching more people. It might be faster, might get more of a hearing. What's worth keeping, and what do you think we should move away from? Maybe not back, but to something else or something broader.
From my own perspective, I felt the conventional engagement and consultation process on planning applications, on regeneration proposals, has been inadequate for a really long time. In an ideal world, that whole process could be restructured using this impetus from this sort of way that things have had to shift during COVID, that this kind of focus on, yeah, you do need to meet people, actually, you do need to find a way of connecting to people, and also need to find a way of, like, as Jenna was saying, getting people involved or interested in something that might on the surface appear to not directly affect them. But in an ideal world, this whole situation with COVID would give a sort of opportunity to reverse the order of things and find ways of getting to know the people before you have to do a consultation or an engagement on something that is going to happen. And in a way, the sort of mutual aid stuff has enabled that to happen a bit, where people start to build more community relationships than before. But it's like, what is the role of people who are involved in initiating urban change when there's also these sort of grassroots communities that have been built up during this time of crisis? Then you can see the sort of benefits that have come from this sort of bottom-up grassroots organizing, and that is now almost in direct conflict with this kind of idea of like top-down decision making, going to go and now engage with people on it. Obviously it's very idealistic and probably quite utopian, but I still think it's worth putting those kinds of ideas out there, because otherwise, you know, how do you ever get things to change?
This is the great pause, isn't it, in terms of how we do things. Oh, Jenna's got a question. Jenna, over to you on that note of idealism.
I think this is a really interesting question. I wanted to pose it as I was preparing for today. It kind of came into my mind, and actually you've kind of brought it up, which is the role of local government in all of this. My perspective is that we have seen local authorities really prove themselves to people through this crisis. I mean, you know, we know the kind of dire financial straits that COVID has left them in, but also that they have been absolutely crucial to the on the ground support and response to people. Here lies within there a kind of whole commentary on how our national government has fared, et cetera, et cetera. We won't get into that. But I wonder whether this crisis will make people rethink their perception of local government and our level of trust in local government. And therefore, I'm really interested in your comments, Sim, about the sort of power lying in the hands of decision makers and that being in conflict with the grassroots, because presumably the decision makers in planning largely are our democratically elected local representatives. So is that in conflict, or actually do we just need to ensure that those democratically elected local representatives know what they're doing, have really great ways of engaging with their communities, and ensure that the perception is that they genuinely speak for and represent them in these decisions? I mean, we have a system that represents communities at a really quite local level, ward level, and we even in some cases have neighborhood planning, so we have neighborhood forums, which is even more hyper local than that. So it seems to me we sort of do have the system, and you know, there are plenty of ways you could criticize it, but actually I'm genuinely interested, is that do you see that as a conflict, or actually that we could use the system that we have better?
I've got a point on that, Sib. One of the things that you see all the time, and I'm going to go to Sib on this, is who has the influence. The system and all the players are there, but it's who gets listened to most, and how much democratic access is there. There's going to be a future episode actually on digital access and how that is fair or unfair in terms of people's life advantage and access to broadband and et cetera. But Sib, did you want to come back on that comment? Jamal, I know you're there in the background. I'm going to come to you in a second, then we'll wrap up.
I mean, you kind of actually just said what I was going to say. The thing that I was missed out in that description of how what local government does and is listening, there needs to be a way of building trust between the local government and the community to ensure that they are seen as a body that listens to what people need. And I feel like that at the moment, absolutely not criticizing the local government's COVID responses, because I think on the whole they've been amazing, but that definitely the perception of the local council as a body that listens to people is not necessarily widespread, and that there is a need that has also been recognised in Newham, a need to rebuild trust between the council and the community, and that you do that through listening and through building up those kinds of relationships. And I guess that's what I mean by conflict, is that obviously there are always things that overlap between what residents and communities need and also council needs to develop, right? And there are overlaps where those two things are aligned and they're the same thing, and there are also areas where they diverge. And I think that a lot of the time that is not explicitly said, And it's sort of like, we know what we're doing. We're doing the best for you because we know what we're doing. And that as an attitude can be quite divisive or disruptive. And that's the thing that I think causes the conflict. It just would be quite helpful to have those kinds of explicit conversations where it's like, we know that everything we do is not going to be aligned with what everybody wants. So that's a more open dialogue already of accepting the fact that there is a disagreement. It might not always be true that the local authority knows what they're doing, and it might not always be true that what the community wants is best for the area, and that those two things have to also coexist.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Jamal, I'm going to come to you. You are obviously working kind of on the ground with residents in West Kentish Town Estate. What I was going to ask you, Jamal, was this idea of representing residents' voices and hearing them. You are on the ground. You have a lot of trust with the people in that estate, from what I gather. Does it feel like they can continue to be listened to? I mean, whether we are online or not, do you feel like you're in a place of optimism or pessimism about community voice? How are you feeling?
We do listen. I agree 100% with Sib, and it's all about listening to the residents. I think is really key. Even though you can't promise everything what they want, if it's something that we can do to do a change and we can all come together and change, not as a West Kentish, as a community, to change something that is for better for the community, and I'm all for it, and I'm sure all residents will be all for it as well. But it's quite hard because there's some residents who might want something, and then other community or this West Kentish Town Estate might want something, and then the wider community might want something different. Then you got that, you know, conflict.
There's something too about being online where it's very tempting because everyone has agreed that sessions, unless they're long committee sessions and they get cut off, the sessions tend to be shorter. And it's very tempting to have a one-way session with some Q&A at the end, where if you had a live session, people can ask you things as they go through, which is a much more natural way. And someone waiting an hour or 2 hours to speak might just give up. So I think there's something about anyone having online sessions has got to say, we will make space for questions during.
A lot of people who join this online session are shy to ask questions, or they get scared there'll be someone else that is taken over the meeting and kept asking the question. So we do remind residents to have questions already to give to us that we could answer anonymously. So we don't need to say, oh, Lisa asked this question. We just say, a resident asked this question, blah, blah, blah. And then we answer it, and then it just answers for them.
Yeah, that's not just residents too. I mean, we do that. Future of London runs courses for leaders, and because the people who they're hearing from are very senior for them, we offer them the chance to ask questions anonymously beforehand. So it's not just about residents and what they know. It's, I think, anyone, as you say, who might be shy or get drowned out. If you're representing them, that's great. I think what you said earlier, Jamal, is a great way to wrap up, that really it's all about listening to residents and to other constituents, really, whether it's small business or, you know, anyone in the neighborhood or who's being addressed. That's a great way to end. Yeah. So there you have it, kind of a how to and possibly how not to of community engagement from three people operating across aspects of community consultation and engagement. I hope you found that useful. Watch for resources on the Future of London website. There'll be connections for you to take advantage of. For now, I'm Lisa Taylor, and this has been Future of London City Bites. Thanks for listening. For information on other episodes and on the Learning from Crisis program, visit futureoflondon.org.uk. Goodbye.